Today, climbing a 100-meter tether. Someday, 60,000 miles. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Ben Shalef, who is the CEO of the Spaceward Foundation. The Spaceward Games 2007 are moving to Salt Lake City and the Davis County Event Center. We'll talk a little bit about why that is and what you could expect to see when you go there. First of all, Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the evolution to this point of the Spaceward Games. We're looking specifically this year at a couple of very precise challenges, but what is the overall history of the Spaceward Games?
We started the Spaceward Games with a space elevator competition that ran in 2005 for the first time. And back then, it was a pretty unique challenge because unlike running, say, a solar car race or a rocketry club, nobody's ever built space elevator prototype for a competition before. So we kind of had to get it going from scratch, which is why in 2005, we ran what we call the half-form competition, where we provided the power beaming system and the teams only built the receiving end, that is the climber and the power conversion circuitry.
All right, we should pause for just a moment here and explain to people what this technology is we're talking about. This first appeared, I remember seeing this in popular science maybe in the late 60s, where they're talking about a tethered cable on the surface of the Earth extending out into space, which would revolutionize the cost of getting to space with cargo or people, because now you could have some sort of device that climbed this tether into orbital space using obviously far less energy than is expended in sending a rocket up there. So these games are focused on developing technology toward that end. Let me ask the big question that escapes most people intuitively when they ponder this notion, and that is, what holds up the other end?
Right. That is the number one question, of course. And it is pretty much the same answer as what holds up a satellite. At the end of the tether is basically an object, a heavy object. We call it the counterweight. And it is not quite a satellite because it's actually moving faster than a satellite. It is superorbital, which means if it weren't tied down with our tether, it would actually fly out of orbit. But given that it's tied down with that tether, it just keeps it tight. And that's it. It's the rotation of the Earth, in short.
All right. Now, does this require this counterweight object to be in a more distant orbit than just a free orbital satellite would be?
Right. It is. The entire system spins around the Earth at exactly geosynchronous rate once every day, but the location of the counterweight is beyond geosynchronous orbit. So a satellite at that altitude would have been moving slower, but it's moving at one revolution per day.
Okay, and the extent to which the orbit is placed outside geosynchronous determines the maximum weight of an object which can then climb the tether.
Right. The more, this is sort of your engineering parameter, the more distant you make it or the heavier, you get more tension in the tether, which allows you to have a heavier climber on it.
All right. Now, what is the altitude above the surface of the Earth that this counterweight would typically be placed, at least in theory?
So geosynchronous orbit is 25,000 miles away or 40,000 kilometers away, which is quite a ways out. And theoretically, we could have the counterweight just, a single mile beyond that. But the way it works out, if we did that, that counterweight would have to be very heavy. The further out you go, the lighter it can be. And so there's sort of an optimal point, which ends up at about 60,000 miles. And that's where it is.
Wow. So that's more than double the geosynchronous distance from the Earth.
Yes, indeed.
So you're talking about a tether which can not only withstand the forces imposed by a heavy object pulling it taut from 60,000 miles away, you're now talking about a tether which can withstand that plus whatever forces are generated by some sort of vehicle or cargo pod climbing that tether.
Right. But when you work it out, it turns out that most of the tension in the cable is due to its own self-weight. The climber is almost meaningless on it. So, and that is the reason also why we're looking for all the carbon nanotube technology to come in and create a stronger tether, because today's materials cannot hold their own weight at that length. So you need a stronger cable. Most of the tension is just carrying its own weight. Once it's there, the climber is relatively insignificant on top of that.
All right. Now, this leads us, if you're going to develop this technology, this leads us to the two challenges that are the major components of the Spaceward Games 2007. One is the Tether Challenge. If we know carbon nanotubes will probably be the answer, what are the intermediate steps to get there? Because you have a prize offered for exceeding whatever the previous year's best technology could offer by 50%.
Right. The technology map for the Tether is pretty clear. If something, and we're realists, I mean, if something can be made that is that strong, it will be made out of carbon nanotubes because they're the only core molecule that is strong enough to do that. They're strong by about a factor of two than what we need. But weaving them into a cable is difficult. It's hard to make composites where the fibers are stronger than a certain degree because they just pull out of the composite. And so it's an incremental process. This is just technology being refined. It's no longer sort of a revolution that's necessary. It's just an evolutionary progress in making carbon nanotube cables. And what we're offering is exactly that. We have what is basically a tug-of-war machine that'll compare any two tethers that weigh the same weight. And we will bring the best cable that we can buy on the market that weighs only 2 grams. And you will bring the best thing you can build, the best tether you can make that it weighs only 2 grams. And if you can beat our tether, you will be the winner of that challenge.
Okay, but you have to beat it by 50%, right?
Correct. What we add there is we don't want somebody winning by a hair because the progression has to be measurable. Mm-hmm. So we have a minimum step size, which is get better by a factor of 1.5. 50% better. And we implement that by giving ourselves sort of an unfair advantage. Our sample actually, our sample at the last stage is actually allowed to weigh 3 grams versus your 2 grams. But of course, we're allowed only off-the-shelf materials, whereas you can use what you developed at home, which presumably will include the carbon nanotubes.
Now, is development in carbon nanotubes beyond the reach of home experimenters?
It is not. We'd be surprised if the winner comes out of the home lab. It would probably be a university's materials science department or a small company that's just made a breakthrough in the lab. Making a material is a lot harder than making, say, a climber for the other competition. We're aware of that. We are expecting sort of the tether competition to always lag in terms of the successes after the climber competition, but that's why we kind of couple them together, sort of they balance each other out. But, you know, we can be surprised. Sometimes an advance in something like that can come from a relatively modest laboratory.
Now, tell us about the other part of the challenge, which is the climber challenge. This looks like it would be fun to watch, and it's gotten to the point where it's over 300 feet tall.
Yeah. The other technical issue with the space elevator, the sort of the hurdle, is how do you power an electric vehicle that's traveling out some 25,000 miles towards orbit? You only have to power it on the first half of the trip. So the solution that was proposed by Dr. Edwards in the year 2000 is to use technology called power beaming, which is basically using solar cells, but given that the sunlight is not intense enough, just illuminating the climber with a beam of light that is about 10 times as intense as the sun. That's about what it takes to move at the speeds we want to move. And this technology, people have been experimenting with it, but it is not widely used. And what we're doing is we're asking teams to basically replicate that. We don't have to go 60,000 miles. We're talking here about a 400-foot climb. It's about 40 stories. Or actually, it's 100 meters, to be totally correct, this year. And what the teams bring in is basically the climber. It's like a solar car, but sort of on steroids because it has to drive straight up. It takes a lot of power to go straight up. And some sort of energy beam, and we're allowing any energy beam they can think of in order to power it. They're not allowed to have batteries, not allowed to have fuel.
So it has to be completely solar-powered?
It has to be beam-powered. We have a variety of beams. What I was beginning to say before we went into the background discussion on the space elevator, in 2005, in order to get things going, we provided the beam. So everybody ran off of the same beam, and so we didn't have a lot of diversity, but that was part of the plan, just to get things going. In 2006, last year, was the first year where the teams brought the entire system. And most of the team basically replicated the technology we used in 2005, but three teams started experimenting with other types of power beams, microwave beams and infrared beams. And this year, second year that we'll be holding the full form competition, we have 5 microwave teams, microwave beams. We have 2 infrared beams, which are very impressive technologically. Actually, I have to say that I'm very surprised at the huge amount of advance there is between 2006 and 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a number of teams that are replicating something that a team by the name of Kansas City Space Pirates did last year, which was use directly reflected sunlight as the power source. So that would be a solar power beaming system. So we have, I think, four of them this year. And it's promising to be quite a high-performance show.
All right, well, let's talk about how that show will unfold in just a moment. We're talking today with Ben Shalef, who is the CEO of the Spaceward Foundation, and we're talking about the Spaceward Games 2007. We'll be back to talk more about it in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and known ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. Clarity Aloft headsets are known for the superior clarity of sound. They're lightweight but rugged enough to meet military specifications. Best of all, they boast better noise reduction than ANR in the speech frequencies that matter most to you. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt. Talking today with Ben Shalef, who is the CEO of the Spaceward Foundation. We're talking about the Spaceward Games 2007, which will be held in the Salt Lake City area in Utah at the Davis County Event Center, October 19th through the 21st. Ben, tell us why these games have moved from Las Cruces.
That was just basically a matter of, well, logistics. As you know, XPRIZE this year is being run as a component of an air show. And the air show has very strict rules about how tall you can stick a crane up by their runway. And that didn't work out very well. So as much as we would have liked to run with them, that just wasn't an option. And pretty much around the same time, folks from Salt Lake called in. They have a really nice facility. It's the County Fairgrounds facility. It's a very nice kind of new facility, nice buildings, nice lawn. Has everything we need. And, we liked it very much.
Well,
so we're holding it.
Tell us about the foundation. How does the Spaceward Foundation raise its money, and what's its ultimate goal? Is it an operating space tether, the ultimate goal of the organization?
So, what we do with Spaceward is we take care of sort of the social engineering of far-reaching space concepts. There's sort of a problem with space concepts that are not 2 years in the future, that they seem too far to even get started on.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of they're not in the roadmap because they're too far, and they never get in there because they're not on the roadmap. And so they always remain 10, 15 years away, and nothing ever happens. And we thought that what we need to do is take those space concepts that are far off and bring them to life and advocate them. And so when the people that participate in our competition, the teams for the university students, when they graduate and they move into aerospace industry, they would have had first-hand experience with these projects. And so when they became decision makers, it wouldn't be a gut reaction of, oh, no, that's too far in the future, we're not going to do that.
Anybody who is successful in these challenges would seem to have a leg up, I would think, in getting involved in the aerospace industry. Somebody's going to want to snap these people up.
For sure, and that would go doubly true this year because, as I said, the level of technical competence and sophistication this year is amazing. We did not expect that, and what these students are pulling off is something that they're very impressive in all objective terms.
Now, who is eligible to enter this? You talk about students. I've heard you mention students a couple of times. Are there small companies, entrepreneurial companies,
also
involved?
It's open to everybody. We have students, which was sort of our main target that we aimed at. But we have private groups. We have a couple of groups affiliated with industry players. And anybody can play.
All right. The games take place over a three-day period, Friday from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m., and then Saturday and Sunday, both days from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. How is this laid out? What will happen on each day?
So we will attempt to have every team climb at least once a day. So every day we're going to go through all the teams in succession. There is a period just before those 3 days where the teams have to qualify, which means they have to demonstrate that their climber, their power beaming system is at least good enough to play in a way, as some minimum performance benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
And once they do that, then they get to play in those 3 days. So we expect to have a maximum of, say, 10 teams, and they would go out about every 30, 45 minutes or so. And that would be the centerpiece of the event. There are a number of other things that are happening around that. First of all, we have what we call Climber Row, which is all the other teams that are not playing at a given time are located in a hangar in a very nice building that becomes sort of a real-life space elevator museum, because we park them basically on ribbons, on tethers we hang from the ceiling, and when you can walk around, you can talk to the teams and view these systems up close and see how they work, which is just very interesting to see how diverse they are and how different from each other. We have another competition for kids called the Light Racer, the Great Light Racer Championship, and you can read all about that at the Spaceward website at spaceward.org, which also has to do with power beaming, except in a lunar exploration context. We have a special AV presentations. We actually have a space elevator movie from Japan and a new film by Alan Chan and a bunch of other things that are sort of screened especially here. You can't see them anywhere else in the U.S. And so you can come in and you can expect a good couple hours of fun, all space elevator based.
Let me finish up with one note I'm sure of interest to pilots. Is there any hazard represented to aircraft flying overhead by these beams being generated?
We cleared it with the FAA. There's procedure for all these things. If you operate a beam like that, there's basically a notice to airmen and a certificate of non-objection from the FAA, and we've got all of that. It's based on the fact that, first of all, they look in the system and they see that it's safe, and second, we have an active safety officer and an active airplane spotter that if there's a plane overhead, we're just going to wait.
General advice to pilots would be make sure to check the NOTAM if you're going to be flying in the area October 19th, 20th, or 21st, or you might be saying, honey, is it warm in here or is it me?
Yep.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us today. We wish you all the best of luck with the Spaceward Games. The innovation coming out of these experimenters is going to be fascinating to watch on a year-to-year basis. This year's event for our listeners is October 19th through the 21st, Davis County Event Center in Farmington, Utah. Ben, we appreciate your taking a few minutes out to talk to our listeners today.
Okay, I'm glad to be here.
Our listeners can find out more details on the 2007 Spaceward Games at www.spaceward.org. And there's also a link to that site from wherever you found this AeroCast. You've been listening to a special feature from AeroNews. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.